The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Emily Harding, and I live in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where I am a homeschool mom and part-time piano teacher. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. U.S. pilots have filed so many reports about encounters with UFOs that the Pentagon launched an investigation.
So I go like this, and it's climbing still. When it gets right in front of me, it just disappears.
Disappears.
Like gone.
We'll tell you what they think is behind these aerial phenomena. Also, a change of direction in Iraq. We'll find out how the U.S. military shift could affect political stability in the country. Plus, the story of an 84-year-old man and his lifelong hobby.
They're almost like they're alive. And even when they're sitting still and they've got a full head of steam, you may think it's just a dead piece of equipment, but it isn't.
It's Thursday, July 29th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler.
Up next, Ken Covington has today's news.
Members of the U.S. Senate voted last night to move forward with debate on a bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure package.
On this vote, the yeas are 67, the nays are 32.
The procedural vote moved the ball down the field, bringing a bill one step closer to passage. It followed President Biden's pronouncement hours earlier that the White House and lawmakers had ironed out many of their differences on the spending package.
Looks like you reached a bipartisan agreement on infrastructure. Fancy word for bridges, roads, transit systems, high-speed internet, clean drinking water.
The president heard there at an event in Pennsylvania. The lead GOP negotiator, Senator Rob Portman, told reporters at the Capitol,
"We look forward to moving ahead, having the opportunity to have a healthy debate here in the chamber regarding an incredibly important project for the American people."
Still, the agreement only pushes the package toward consideration by the full Senate. It's unclear if enough Republican senators will support final passage. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said Wednesday that the U.S. economy continues to bounce back from the pandemic recession, and he hinted that the Fed might begin to dial back its ultra-low interest rate policies perhaps later this year.
Indicators of economic activity and employment have continued to strengthen, and real GDP this year appears to be on track to post its fastest rate of increase in decades.
Powell acknowledged that the Delta variant has COVID-19 cases on the rise once again, but he said with each new surge, quote, there has tended to be less in the way of economic implications from each wave. And he said it's reasonable to expect that the Delta wave will not derail the rebounding economy. For now, the central bank is keeping its benchmark short-term rate pegged near zero. The Fed will also continue to buy $120 billion in treasury and mortgage bonds each month. Some states and businesses are scrambling to change course on mask guidelines. That after the CDC Tuesday called on even vaccinated Americans to once again wear masks in public, including in schools. White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said she understands that many are not happy about the CDC's announcement, but
this needed to happen, right? They are following the science. We have to listen to public health experts.
Nevada and Kansas City were among the locations that moved swiftly to reimpose indoor mask mandates. In Florida, about two dozen protesters staged a mask burning outside a Broward County school board meeting as the board considers requiring face coverings in the upcoming school year. In a handful of Republican-led states, lawmakers have made it illegal for schools to require masks. The CDC said the Delta variant is a game changer, spreading easily even among vaccinated people, and that, it said, was one of the main reasons for changing its mask guidance. Pfizer has revealed new data about the long-term effectiveness of its COVID-19 vaccine. It suggests that the vaccine loses its effectiveness slightly over time, but remains strongly protective for at least 6 months. World's Kristen Flavin has details.
The new data come from the 44,000-person study of the Pfizer vaccine that persuaded the FDA to grant emergency authorization. The company has tracked the participants of that study for 6 months and counting. Researchers found the efficacy against any symptomatic illness dropped gradually every 2 months. A couple of months after vaccination, protection peaked at 96%. By month four, efficacy was 90%, and by 6 months, 84%. U.S. health officials will weigh those findings as they consider whether booster shots may be needed down the road. Pfizer estimates that getting a third shot more than 6 months after vaccination will greatly boost protection against the Delta variant. The company said it does plan to seek authorization for boosters. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
The Biden administration wants to harden America's defenses against cyber attacks. Officials on Wednesday announced new performance goals and a voluntary public-private partnership to help protect infrastructure and core sectors. President Biden said this week that he believes a cyber attack against America could one day spark a military war.
Well, if we end up in a war with a major power, it's going to be as a consequence of a cyber breach of great consequence, and it's increasing exponentially the capabilities.
The White House says the cyber attack back in May on the nation's largest fuel pipeline highlighted America's vulnerabilities. The president signed an executive order on Wednesday and directs the Departments of Homeland Security and Commerce to develop a more uniform cybersecurity performance goals for critical infrastructure. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, tracking UFOs plus doomsday climate predictions that don't come true. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, the 29th of July, 2021. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. First up, UFOs. Now, not the flying saucer little green men kind of UFO. Well, not that we know of, anyway. These are flying objects caught on tape that not even the U.S. military can identify. Are they rogue weather balloons, foreign drones, or something else?
The Pentagon drew up a report analyzing 144 confirmed sightings and delivered the results to Congress last month. World's Anna Johansson Brown reports now on what all the fuss is about.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA.
Lieutenant Ryan Graves started seeing UFOs in 2014.
They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west.
Graves was a Navy pilot flying an FA-18 Super Hornet off the coast of Virginia. His plane had just gotten a radar upgrade, and something kept showing up on it. The infrared targeting camera caught it too, an unassuming, disc-shaped blob. But it didn't act the way flying objects are supposed to act.
Well, if there's like a thing, it's rotating.
Graves says he saw objects like that every day for a couple of years. Another pilot almost collided with one. The squadron filed an official mishap report. In the wake of those sightings and hundreds of others like them, Congress commissioned a report in 2020. It directed the Pentagon to assess these objects, figure out if they pose any threat to the United States, and determine whether the Department of Defense is equipped to handle them. The report came out last month, accompanied by lots of hype and speculation. Mark Rodiger is the scientific director at the Center for UFO Studies. It's a research group that analyzes UFO sightings and often identifies what those objects really are. Rodiger says the report got a lot of attention because nobody expected UFOs to be a serious subject.
The government has said that UFOs weren't a subject worthy of investigation. They weren't scientifically interesting, and they weren't a threat. Definitely not a threat.
But now it seems that's changing. The government report detailed 144 verified sightings of UFOs, or as the government calls them, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. And it tried to make sense of them by identifying what they might be. Typically, UFO sightings have pretty boring explanations. People see the moon, or a bird, or a distant plane, or an airborne plastic bag, and report them as UFOs. Mark Rodiger says 95% of sightings can be easily explained. But the objects in the Pentagon report were a little more slippery. Like the Nimitz encounter. In 2004, Alex Dietrich and David Fravor were pilots based on the USS Nimitz off the coast of California. New advanced radar on a nearby ship had detected multiple anomalous aerial vehicles. According to the radar, the objects descended 80,000 feet in less than a second. Dietrich and Fravor took to the skies to investigate. Here's Fravor describing the encounter on 60 Minutes.
So, as we're looking at this, I said, dude, do you see that thing down there?
The two pilots saw a white object, about the size of a fighter plane, shaped like a tic-tac. Alex Dietrich says they saw no wings, no exhaust plumes, no means of propulsion. But the object was moving around erratically.
Like no predictable movement, no predictable trajectory.
Yeah.
It was just
like a ping pong ball.
No acceleration.
Very, very random.
Acceleration.
Fravor tracked the object for about 5 minutes.
So I go like this, and it's climbing still. And when it gets right in front of me, it just disappears.
Disappears.
Like gone.
A few seconds later, the USS Nimitz picked up the object on radar again, this time 60 miles away. The Nimitz encounter is one of the most well-documented UFO sightings. Despite the Pentagon's scrutiny, no one has been able to identify it for sure. In fact, out of all the encounters detailed in its report, the Pentagon was able to identify just one. It was a large, deflating balloon. The rest? No idea.
We all wish we had more data. For most of the incidents, we just don't have enough data.
Andrew Fracknoy is an astronomy professor at the University of San Francisco. He says the Pentagon was very honest in admitting it just didn't have enough information. And that's pretty normal, especially because of the nature of UFOs. They happen quickly. No time for proper study. Sometimes an object might appear to be moving at superhuman speeds, but maybe it's not.
There's a lot of discussion about whether the cameras were moving and the aircraft was moving or the other flying thing was moving. And you have to know the speed of everything to figure out how fast the unknown object was moving.
Mark Rodegier says UFOs are the hardest scientific problem he's ever encountered.
One of the main reasons is we can't predict where they're going to occur. So how do you study something that you don't know when and where it's going to happen?
But the military has a vested interest in figuring out what these objects are. Many UFO sightings have been near U.S. training or testing sites. And if there's some kind of new breakthrough technology from another country, the government wants to know about it. But if this is new tech from Russia or China, it's far, far beyond anything the United States has. The objects appear to maneuver abruptly at speeds hundreds of times faster than our fastest jets. The report also left open another possibility, a catch-all other bin. Here's Mark Rodegier.
They don't use the word aliens, but we all know they mean aliens.
There's no proof these objects are extraterrestrial, but the report left the door open for further investigation. Rodegier says that's a reasonable way to do it.
You know, one thing we keep in mind is that we don't know a lot about the universe, you know, and we don't know a lot about our brains. We do know some things. But to think that we know even most of what there is to know is actually crazy.
Regardless of what the objects are, the Pentagon report concluded they do pose a safety threat to pilots. So the report calls for extra training for military personnel and a reporting system for when pilots encounter anything they can't explain. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson Brown.
Up next, the United States enters a new chapter in the Middle East. New phase is the exact phrase that President Biden used this week to describe changes to the U.S. military's mission in Iraq.
It's just to be available, to continue to train, to assist, to help, and to deal with ISIS as it arrives. But we are not going to be, by the end of the year, in a combat mission.
The president heard there after a White House meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi. Now, no word yet on what that might mean for U.S. troop levels in Iraq. About 2,500 U.S. service members are currently stationed there. So what exactly does this announcement mean for American troops, for the Iraqi people, and for stability in Iraq and the Middle East? Here to answer those questions is Benham Bin Talibu. He is a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Benham, good morning.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, when the president announced ending the combat mission this year in favor of a support role, that may have surprised some people. I mean, some may be asking, wait, didn't that happen a long time ago? So what is the U.S. military's role in Iraq right now? And what combat operations are they carrying out?
Well, the U.S. military returned to Iraq, as we know, to fight the Islamic State. It's still governed by, when the U.S. left Iraq in 2011, it was forced to come back because of strategic and political vacuums in that country that led to the rise of the Islamic State. So most of the U.S. military mission actually was geared, when it returned in 2014, towards fighting off that entity, and then eventually helping train, equip, stand up, and support Iraqi forces wherever necessary. You know, they would engage in joint operations together, be co-located at different bases together. And I want to stress that when the U.S. did return, it returned under a multinational auspices because there was a coalition fighting the Islamic State. But when President Biden recently talked about a potential drawdown of troops and the changing of the mission, it's in recognition, at least in his administration's eyes, of the need to draw down the U.S. force presence in the region. And ultimately, the U.S. will be retaining the troops, the very minimal troop presence, I should say, to support those Iraqi forces that it does want to support from a distance and continue to advise and assist. I think this is a fool's errand, however, because ultimately it will leave the state open for predation from Iraq's neighbor, Iran, and it fundamentally misreads the nature of U.S. forces there, which is an economy of force mission.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that the Obama administration made the controversial decision to pull out of Iraq rather precipitously, and many analysts say that contributed to the rise of ISIS. How does what President Biden is planning differ from President Obama's decision?
It's an excellent question, but in short, I think we're preparing for the same mistake, preparing to make the same mistake. You know, political timetables for drawdowns, while I absolutely understand the imperative of that, and to be frank with the American people about any changing scope of mission, let the troops there themselves have the proper defenses and support, but that ultimately that their deployment, that the blood and treasure spent, is not in vain. And I think a time-based withdrawal would not learn from the lessons of history from the Obama-era withdrawal, and ultimately could also be missing the forest through the trees here, which is, are you willing to commit marginal resources for maximal gain? Because while the point of strengthening the, you know, Iraqi security forces is to be able to stand up the Iraqi state better, prevent, you know, armed terrorists and violent extremists from running amok in that country as ISIS did, there are other armed terrorists, violent extremists that fall under the auspices of this group called the Popular Mobilization Forces, or the Popular Mobilization Units, which are mostly but not exclusively Shia militias, mostly loyal to the Islamic Republic. And over-focusing on the ISIS threat while missing this rising Trojan horse in the country is something I think the U.S. military posture is getting ready to do. And again, it's kind of like watching a car accident in slow motion. I guess the fast motion version is what's happening in Afghanistan.
Mm. Let's talk about the state of Iraq right now. How stable or unstable is Iraq? And what does the power dynamic look like in that country right now?
It really depends on how you define stability. Is it relative to progress made in that country from some past prime ministers? There's no doubt that Khatami is better. But every opportunity for a crisis is really manifesting itself for him and manifesting itself for the U.S. relationship, whether you talk about water, electricity shortages, whether you talk about major political protests in 2019, that was a huge phenomenon we can't ignore, as well as you talk about the politics of the U.S. force presence in that country, because lest we forget, there is a contingent inside the parliament that is trying to use the cycle of violence, that is begotten by the pro-Iran-backed militias firing rockets, mortars, and really since this April, more advanced drones. They're trying to use that cycle of violence to evict America and to enshrine a narrative of we kicked the Americans out the door as we did in 2011. So there are very major fault lines. There are very major cleavages. There are very real issues. Unless we forget, of course, COVID has exacerbated these very real issues. The Iraqis need money, the Iraqis need support, and they really do feel like they're between a rock and a hard place sometimes between the U.S. and Iran.
Benham Bentalibou with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies has been our guest. Benham, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Argentine Olympic fencer Maria Belén Pérez Maurice lost her only fencing event at the Summer Games. Hungary's Anna Martin beat her 15-12 in the women's saber. But she's still coming home with gold. As she was being interviewed by Argentina's Tai Chi Sports after the match, her coach and boyfriend, Lucas Saucedo, sneaked in behind her holding up a sign.
Oh, and what did the sign say?
It read in Spanish, "Will you marry me, please?" Saucedo then dropped to one knee to await her reply. And as you can probably guess from her reaction, the answer was a resounding yes. It's a happy ending to her 2021 Olympic journey. On guard. It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Thursday, July 29th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, connecting with the past. Technological progress has improved efficiency just about everywhere, including train travel and farming. But efficiency isn't everything. One man in North Central Illinois says that the old ways still have a lot to teach us. Here's World intern Josh Schumacher with his story.
This steam whistle isn't on a train. It's actually on a tractor. A tractor in North Central Illinois, and one that belongs to Neil Drummer.
How old are you?
I'm 84. Almost 85. We don't talk about that.
Now, Drummer may be the most youthful octogenarian you'll ever meet. He's lively and enthusiastic, and that probably has something to do with the fact that he hangs out with something older than he is.
So, what is this right here?
It's a 1920 Port Huron steam traction engine. The word tractor comes from that expression.
These Port Huron steam engine tractors were used primarily for farming. Everything from plowing, threshing grain, cutting wood, and baling hay. The steam can even be diverted to boil corn, steam mushrooms, and even help mix asphalt, all of which are activities that this tractor has participated in over the course of its 100-year life.
And how long have you been doing this?
Well, in a sense, ever since the day I was born. I was being born in the house when they were out in the yard with one of these engines threshing grain. And I got my first whiff of coal smoke through the open window. I tell people that.
When Drummer was a boy, his family farm had a steam engine just like this one.
And of course, the steam engine itself is just, to me, was a source of fascination from the time I was able to walk. And scared to death of it, but I couldn't stay away from it either, you know. At that time, it was rather overwhelming to little guys, you know.
Neil Drummer lived through the transition from steam power to diesel, both on the farm and on the tracks. Now, diesel might be more efficient, but the new engines lack the romance of steam. And Drummer mourns that loss. As a child, he used to ride around in the caboose of the steam engine trains to the neighboring towns with his friends. The engineers let the boys explore the steam engine whenever they ran off to grab a bite to eat. And that's when Drummer discovered what he wanted to be when he grew up, a train engineer on one of those steam engines. But when steam power largely disappeared from the railroads during the 1950s, so did that dream. However, in 1971, Drummer found a new outlet for his love of steam engines in the form of a 19-horse Port Huron steam engine tractor for sale in Ewing, Missouri.
Got to bring the engine home, got to take the plunge. It was $3,000 at that time, which was a chunk of change for me at that point.
Drummer bought it, and, well, he's never looked back. In fact, it's kind of become a part of the family. He's got photos of it in his house, and he speaks of it affectionately. He insists that the tractor isn't just a lifeless object.
They're almost like they're alive. When they're fired up, they wake up and they go to sleep. And even when they're sitting still, and they've got a full head of steam, you may think it's just a dead piece of equipment, but it isn't. It's wide awake, even when it's not moving or making any sound, you know.
And this sense that they're alive doesn't end there.
It seems like this is kind of like a combination between like driving a truck and riding a horse.
Almost. And they don't call them iron horse for nothing. And there's no two of them that are exactly alike the way they feel when you get used to them, which is one of the characteristics of a horse. And a few other things.
Like horses, steam engines require more care the older they get.
The firebox, most of it, is original stuff. And it's got to have some work done on the bottom sometime within the next couple of years.
Drummer's been refurbishing and restoring this tractor for, well, about 50 years now. It's hard work, and he has the scars to prove it.
You get scarred up and burnt and everything else. I learned that the hard way.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's the story there?
Just things that you touch.
Yeah.
Or you get splinters in your hands handling all this stuff and things like that. Or hit the side of the door and then it jams your hand. Like when I smashed my finger putting the grates in. Oh, that did hurt. And that finger there has been like that ever since. It's been cold. So I did some damage. Things like this. But that was not the fault of the engine, that was my own. But right then I was gonna junk the steam engine, get rid of this thing, enough is enough. You say lots of things.
Yeah, like what?
Well, you wouldn't want to record it. A couple of things. Yeah, you dirty, rotten lowdown. And some other things.
Drummer's hands are one of the few things that do betray his age. They shake as he plays the organ, which he does for his church every Sunday, and he has a hard time writing with a pen. Beyond that, however, he insists that they're fine, and he has the handshake to prove it. The 84-year-old drummer stays busy all summer long. He says it's a tiring and expensive hobby, but he sees the tractor as a means to an end. It's about connecting with our past and with each other. He hopes that his tractor will keep steaming along even after he's gone, and he hopes that new generations will appreciate it the same way that he has. But in the meantime, Neil Drummer and his tractor will keep on keeping each other young. Reporting for World, I'm Josh Schumacher in Lamoille, Illinois.
This weekend, Neil Drummer's in Iowa displaying his tractor at a steam event as he celebrates his 85th birthday. Today is Thursday, July 29th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. If you need a reason to dismiss the worst-case scenarios peddled by climate change activists, commentator Cal Thomas has you covered.
We've had them among us from the beginning. Fortune tellers, diviners, readers of palms, charlatans all. They attempt to convince the gullible they have unique powers to accurately predict the future. When it comes to climate change, modern soothsayers are declared legitimate by the media, even when their predictions turn out to be wrong. The latest is President Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry. His scientific credentials are non-existent. Nevertheless, he recently predicted we have only 100 days to save the planet from climate disaster. He made that chicken little prediction at the UN climate summit a few days ago, so we'd better subtract the days that have followed. In February, Kerry told CBS This Morning that the world has 9 years before doomsday. What happened in the last 5 months to advance his forecast? He doesn't say, and reporters won't ask him. These kinds of apocalyptic climate predictions are nothing new. In 1967, Stanford University biologist Paul Ehrlich claimed, quote, "It is already too late for the world to avoid a long period of famine," unquote. He also declared the U.S. population too big. He suggested the government might need to impose involuntary birth control through sterilizing agents put into staple foods and drinking water. Today, Americans are far from starving to death. In fact, obesity is a major health problem. And last year, the annual U.S. population growth rate dropped to its lowest level in 100 years. Ehrlich also predicted in 1969, everyone will disappear in a cloud of blue steam by 1989. To quote from a Stephen Sondheim musical, "I'm still here." In 1970, a scientist named James P. Lodge Jr. predicted a new ice age by the 21st century. Here we are, 21 years into the 21st century, and some experts are saying the opposite. No wonder critics call it junk science. Apologists claim scientists like Ehrlich and Lodge based their predictions on information available at the time. Yet they want to make changes that would affect our lives and lifestyles, perhaps for all time. It's all about control, not individual freedom. In 1972, two members of the Department of Geological Science at Brown University wrote President Richard Nixon with another dire warning. The letter said, quote, "The main conclusion of the meeting was that a global deterioration of climate by order of magnitude larger than any hitherto experienced by civilized mankind is a very real possibility and indeed may be due very soon." Nearly 50 years later, we're still waiting for the sky to fall. And those are just a few of the climate predictions that haven't come true. Little has changed since these ludicrous statements were made half a century ago, and now they're being repeated in new ways by today's climate fear mongers. When will we learn to stop believing them? I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow, Culture Friday. The Mississippi Attorney General is challenging the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade. She's hoping to not just make abortion illegal, but unthinkable. And a popular streaming series about a thief who uses his questionable skills to right past wrongs. That and more tomorrow. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The psalmist reminds us that some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Go now in grace and peace.